Blog Talk.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, everybody. This is Greg Russack sitting in for Egberto Willis on Politics Done Right. Thanks for joining me today. I'm looking forward to a very energetic and lively discussion, hopefully some answers around the issue of why more people aren't more engaged actually in the conversation and what we're doing about trying to improve the circumstances of our country. I want to start off by just telling you here's what the basic premise was for me this morning, and that was, on some level, silence is surrender. And really, the premise of this show is about this. And I want people who are undecided, non-committed, the folks who say they're in the middle on issues, to really call in and tell us why. And the reason for that is simple. You're the majority. You're the ones who actually can control the direction that this country goes in. And by not engaging in the discussion, by not showing up on election day, by forfeiting your role as a citizen, allowing the rest of us, and I say us, I mean me, and lots of other folks who are more engaged, but also, frankly, I think tend to be somewhat more extreme. We're the ones who are going to be making the decisions. It's on you to really participate. Call in and tell me why you're not. Now, I know there's a little bit of a kind of irony here to this whole thing, right? This is Blog Talk Radio. This is Coffee Party Radio. This is Politics Done Right. There's a real good chance that if you're calling into the show, if you're listening to me right now, either on the phone, that number, 646-929-2495, for anybody listening on the internet, and who is only listening there to dial in to talk, it's 646-929-2495. And if you're already dialed in and listening, of course, all you have to do is press 1. That will indicate to me that you would like to add to the discussion, be a part of the conversation, and I would welcome that, of course. It looks like we do have a caller already. I'm going to go ahead and unmute the mic for 620. 620, tell us who you are, where you're calling from, and what your thoughts are.
Okay, 620-453.
Hey, Jack, how are
okay,
you?
Okay, this is fine.
Good.
Yeah, you're a friend of mine on Facebook. I have not been on Facebook for the last 3 months. I don't know
oh
because...
Oh, my goodness. Are you okay?
I'm okay. It's because my granddaughter... I bought this computer for my granddaughter, and the thing doesn't connect with the internet. That's, yeah. The stuff I want to talk about is, well, one thing took 166 days or so to get Loretta Lynch in for Attorney General. That's probably one of the key prospects, one of the key positions in the government, the federal government.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. I'm talking to you. I'm going to mention two things we have to fight.
Okay.
And that's extremism and fundamentalism. Together, they are the platforms of ISIS, which we should not even call ISIS, refer to the Islamic State, because you're recognizing the fact that there is an Islamic State. I don't know if it's a fact. It's a misconception. And all this hemming and hawing
let me ask you a question, Jack, about extremism and fundamentalism, because I will tell you that I am oftentimes referred to as a bit of an extremist. That's a word that has a lot of connotation to it. You know, it has a lot of baggage to it, right? Views on how things should operate in terms of our government. in terms of our economy, in terms of social issues. For some people, my views are considered to be extreme. Now, what I'm trying to figure out, and you're a very active citizen. You're one of the folks like me, I think, that is part of the discussion. We're always thinking about, we're always talking about what's going on in our government, what's happening in society. What I'm still trying to figure out is what the 60% of the voting population doesn't show up for an election. How do we get them off the couch and engaged in the conversation? What do you think?
Okay, it's a matter of motivating them, and I think the Republicans, except the Tea Party guys, are dominating the discussion. It's a matter of maybe 30 or 40 people in the House have wagged. It's a dog that is a, mm-hmm. it's a tail. It's not the tail that wags the dog. It's a dog that wags the. It's a tail that wags the dog.
Yeah, right. I tend to agree with that. I agree that there's a lot of energy. There's a lot of effort put into.
I also call myself a militant moderate. Now, militant means you're definitely for the center. I'm against the extreme right or the extreme left.
That's an interesting term. The militant moderate is actually kind of in line with one of the suggestions that was made in the chat room when the question was posed. You know, how do we get people more engaged? I'm going to call them your fellow militant moderates in the middle. How do we get more of you, more of them engaged? And one of the suggestions in the chat room is, and I tend to agree with this, get them pissed off. One of the things that I think, at least from where I sit, when I look out and try to think about what are the important issues that we have, and there's a long list of them, and those of us like yourself, like myself, who try to pay attention to these things, the list is long, right? There's the money and politics issue. There's campaign finance reform and electoral reform. There's voter rights and voter suppression. There are trade deals. The list just goes on and on, right?
The people we need to get
motivated, they aren't you and they aren't me. They aren't the people that are in this chat room today. They aren't the people dialed in listening to this discussion right now. It's everyone else who really, on some level, thinks like they can't be bothered. Or, more importantly, and this is where I really like to see this conversation go, is that everybody's the same. Both parties are the same. I have this discussion on a regular basis with lots of folks who, like yourself, like myself, we're looking for answers. We're trying to understand where the discussion should lead us, who should lead us in that direction, and who are the champions that will – on some level, have everyone's or at least as many people's best interests in mind when they either get elected and represent us or when they run organizations in private enterprise to provide a means for an economy to operate. This notion, for me at least, that too many people are too disengaged, and the rationale that I seem to hear is that there's no difference between the parties, I don't buy it. I don't buy that for one second. And while there is plenty of similarities between the parties, and there are lots of folks on both sides who are essentially doing the will of their big donor funders, none of that is in dispute. None of that is in dispute, right? The question becomes, is there enough of a difference between, and let's face reality, we've got a duopoly in this country. There are two parties. There are lots of parties. There are two parties. You go into the voting booth, and essentially your choices are limited. I don't like that as much as anyone else does. I'm a lifelong registered independent. I have voted for independent candidates. I have voted for Republicans. I have voted mostly with Democrats the last 15 years. And there's a reason for that, and that's because both parties are not the same. What do you think?
They are not the same, but I'm going to say that the Democrats are the lesser of two evils. And we against the two-party system because there's big money involved. We got to get rid of this concept
I got another caller waiting on hold. Once you get into the conversation, let's bring in another caller. This is area code 503. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from would be interesting to know as well, and what are your thoughts on today's discussion? 503, go ahead.
503 is calling from Portland, Oregon, from the banks of the Willamette River. Mr. Rusick, it's Dan Aronson. How you doing, Greg? How you doing, Jack?
Doing great, Dan, and thanks for calling in. I know, Jack, I'm going to go ahead and mute your microphone just for a minute. A little bit of background noise. I'll be coming back to you here in a second. Dan, tell us what you're thinking.
Oh,
because I know
fine.
You've got
fun.
Lots of thoughts on this.
This is fun, Greg.
Dan, we only have 47 minutes. Just let you know, okay? Go ahead.
All right. I promise only to take 46 and a half then. right. So all cards on the table for the rest of the audience. So Greg and I have this conversation back and forth by email, and it's great to be able to have it live and on the radio because debate is the key to democracy, right? We have to have conversations about what everybody feels that government should be doing for them. And as much as Greg and I have this debate, I think we tend to agree more than we disagree. And one of the things we agree on is that the 45 years of trickle-down economics that has worked are the will of the government solely for the purposes and the ends of the rich and the big corporations and has screwed the little guy time and again. We need to make up for that. That's what our government needs to be doing right now. So that means we must have a super, not just a progressive agenda, but a super progressive agenda. We need to look at things like raising the minimum wage. We need to get Americans back to work, which means infrastructure investment, which we need anyway. We need to be looking at strengthening the social safety net, not weakening it. We need to be doing all those kinds of things that progressives scream and yell about and say, this is what is right and just. But here's the thing, Greg, and here's where Greg and I here's where it runs off the rails for you and me, right? My point is, you say that there's a big difference between the parties. Forget the parties for a second. Let's talk about the ideologies. Who in government today is standing up for all of those things that I just said?
Universally and completely across the board, 100% in line, probably no one, Dan, right?
Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, maybe. Bernie gets closest, I would think.
Go on his website and listen to it's the Bernie Blitz or it's the Bernie something. He's got a little gimmicky thing, but he talks about these are the things that his office is working on. He's the guy.
Right.
He is the only progressive, and he's independent. So if the independent candidate has moved to the left of the Democrats, then that's the problem is not that we can't govern for the people. The problem is we can't even have the discussion because there's nobody leading for the progressives. We need some strong people in government leading for the progressives so that we can have the debate. Then if we end up saying, you know what, maybe the conservatives are right about this, that, or the other thing, and we can come to some kind of a mix or whatever. I don't know. But
okay.
If we can't even have the debate, how are we going to move things forward?
Let's ask Jack. Jack, you got a thought on how we can move things forward?
Well, I think a little disgusted we've got to have personal contact. I have some 860-odd friends. I hope I still have 860, but yeah, they didn't drop out of my interest. Friends of mine on Facebook. We got to get together physically. Physically get together, get to know each other personally, and they need a face-to-face contact. That, I think, is a solution. The solution is... I have another solution, and that's, I guess I'd be a militant moderate. And the thing that we're fighting is what's happened with the Supreme Court way back in maybe shortly before the Iraqi war broke out by mistake.
So Jack, I want to piggyback on what you were just saying, Jack, about getting together. I actually am completely in support of more interaction on a face-to-face level, and I'm sure Dan agrees with this as well, and anyone else that.
Is that Dan Aronson I'm talking to?
Yes, sir.
That's the other guy on this conversation. The one, the only, Dan Aronson.
Another close friend of mine on Facebook.
You bet, Jack.
Absolutely. And this is where I'm trying to think of
what the heck the. It's not common cause. Just getting to think of the names. I've got a little bit of Alzheimer's on expressions and names.
No worries, Jack. We're here to help you out.
For as far as Obama goes, I oppose the TPP. All these trade agreements were disadvantageous to the average Joe and Jane, which I keep referring to. They're anti-union. Walker.
So Jack, let's pick that. Let's pick that up for a second, Jack. This is one of the issues that I think ought to be energizing people far more than it is. Now, lots of folks will blame mainstream media for not paying enough attention to the issues around.
That's true. Secrecy of the trade.
Yeah, exactly. Secrecy of the trade.
And the New York Times is not the Bible, as far as I'm concerned. New York Times as much as I can criticize. Chicago Tribune. I'm from Chicago originally. Chicago Tribune turned moderate conservative.
Let me make this point then, Jack. When it comes to the issues of the day, and again, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is one of those things that you would think that people would be paying more attention to, but they don't. And I'm trying to fit exactly, and they should. And to your point earlier, having more personal interaction has got to be a key to how we can get people more informed. And to Dan's point, get them a little bit more pissed off. Dan, how do we do this? We're already doing a lot in terms of, maybe we're not doing enough. We spend a lot of time on social media, it seems. At least that's how it looks to me. Dan, what else should we be doing?
Let's just talk to the very simple heart of the problem with the TPP. The TPP benefits nobody but larger corporations.
Yeah,
right? Hey, Jack. I'm going to make your mic.
And who exactly? And who? And who exactly controls 90% of all media outlets in the United States? That would be six very large corporations, all of which who are in love with the TPP, specifically because of the IP section of the IP chapter, the intellectual property chapter, which protects their intellectual property rights. And so are they going to allow their newspapers and their television stations and their radio stations, are they going to allow them to have an open discussion about something that is so beneficial to them and that, you know, again, screws the little guy? Are they going to allow that? No way, Jose. So we are forced to go with blog talk radio and social media as a way of informing people, because the mainstream media is sure as heck, you know, not going to be covering this.
And you have hit exactly on the points that those who will be more engaged, understand the issues, take the time actually, and it takes a little bit of time to do more than get a 30-second soundbite from somebody. And for the vast majority of people who don't really exercise their I'm going to have to stop for a second. For those folks who choose not to spend the time to inform themselves on the facts, you and I both know, Jack knows this as well, Marianne knows it, people who are listening to this show probably are the folks who do this sort of thing. You invest the time to look at as nonpartisan and as accurate sources of information as you can find to try and understand, and then share that information with others and have the kind of conversation that we're having today. But it still mystifies me as to how it is that there are still what seem to me, at least, to be so few of us. And the metric for that measurement Dan, I know you're very sensitized to, is voter participation. If the people in the middle, who represent where the swing will come from, are simply choosing not to be involved in any real meaningful way, then we on the left, I say we meaning me, they meaning anyone else, and I don't mean this to be an us and them, but I'm a liberal and I'm proud of it. Conservatives have a different view of the world and life and government and private sector, and they're free to have those views, but I'm not going to make any bones about it. I want my views to win the day, because I believe that the way this country progresses has always been through more liberal and progressive changes to law, changes to society.
You know, Johnson, but you shouldn't be apologizing for that, Greg, because that's how democracy works. The concept of democracy is real simple. Everybody goes to the polling place and votes their own self-interest. And if everybody participates, then you get the bell curve effect to where the majority of people are voted in that will promote their views. That's how it's supposed to work. But exactly what you said, if only 40% of the people vote, then it's now the bell curve of those 40%. And the people who have interest in how the government works are the people who have been able to purchase influence and make the government work for them. It's the rich and the powerful and the corporations. So they have a vested interest in keeping that going, so they show up at the polls. Meanwhile, the rest of us, or not the rest of us, because I know you and I vote, but people who don't show up sit there and wonder what happened. And that's, you know, that's the old saying, right?
It's interesting you bring up the concept of voting in your self-interest. And I would submit to you that's probably more rare than either of us would like to acknowledge or maybe even admit. And I will cast that light mostly to the right side of the spectrum. If you're not among the one percenters and you're still voting for one percenters and their policies, then you're voting against your own economic self-interest. Now, I know you're going to tell me that both parties are one percenters, and I won't disagree with that. I will not disagree with that, and you know that. The corrupting influence of money
in our politics and in our system of governance is clear to be seen by anybody who wants to see it. If you don't see that, you're not looking, because it's pretty obvious. My only contention is at this point is, if we're going to change the system, then we need to change the kind of people that represent us in that system. And again, I'm sure you agree with that premise. My concern would be, how do we if there's only one Bernie Sanders in all of Congress, how do we get more of them? Where do they
and,
come from?
And the right. Well, that, well, okay. Well, let's view it this way. A television station will put on programming based on its ability to attract a certain type of viewer, so that then they can target certain types of advertisers to gain sponsorship. So just as such, the politicians that are emerging today, they don't look at the 100% and what the 100% want. They look at the 40% or the 60% in presidential years of people who turn out to vote. And so they're just going along with what, you know, give them what they want, right? That's all they're doing, Greg. They're giving what they want, and that they, unfortunately, is that 40 to 60%. It's not the 100%. Because why? Why should I bother going out and stumping and campaigning and spending years of my life to try to push an agenda that I know that the people that I'm that would like this agenda aren't going to bother voting? It's a cat chasing a dog chasing its own tail. It's this self-fulfilling prophecy, and that's the problem. If we could get voter participation to 80%, that would change everything.
And there's no doubt about that. And we have another caller who'd like to get in on the conversation. This is area code 727. Area code 727. What do you think of this?
Hey, Greg. This is Mary Ann calling from Tampa. The idea about getting pissed off that you guys were talking about, I just had a feeling, I have a feeling just from some of the people that I know, I'm wondering if there's some kind of a personality type that leans left and they don't like to get pissed off. So when they see that kind of thing going on, they kind of, you know, move away from the conversation and stay out. That maybe that's part of the reason why they're not engaged. So that's one thought that I had. And as far as, you know, Bernie Sanders being the only one that's working for us, I think, first of all, I think we all know this, getting money out of politics. If, as our friend Janine says, if we could get money out of politics, we could free the elected. And I have a feeling that there's a lot more of them that would work for us if they didn't have to work for the money. So that was another thought that I had. So that's it, pretty much.
Excellent. I you know, thank you, Marianne. And let me just address your first point about I have experience with this as well, although I tend to be the exception to this rule. It does appear to me, based on experience, that people who are of a more liberal mindset do tend to shy away from conflict. They tend to want to allow for all perspectives to have an equal voice and an equal weight in a discussion. I will tell you that I don't necessarily agree with those ideas. My own personal feeling, and on some level, is that, and I was just having this conversation today, actually, with my brother. We have a little bit of a ritual on Saturday mornings, and we'll spend literally hours talking about stuff. And one of the things we talked about today was debates. And debates are great. Those of us who are on this call, Dan, Jack, Marianne, the people in the chat room, we're here because we want to have this conversation. We want to have the discussion. We want to try and figure out what's the root cause of our problems and how do we solve them. But here's the thing that I've always kind of railed against when it comes to the left end of the spectrum, the liberals, my fellow liberals and progressives, is that we tend to get too immersed in the notion of discussion and debate without actually ever getting to resolution, without actually getting to a point where action gets taken. And I'm saying this because I want to connect it in with this thing that I was saying earlier about why both parties are not the same. In my experience, again, this is just me, when it comes to the big important issues of our time and in our past, ultimately debate had to come to an end and action had to get taken. You know, whether it was the civil rights movement, or frankly, whether it was the repeal of Glass, somewhere, somehow, at some point, a position had to be taken, action had to get taken, and the folks on the left, my fellow liberals, who tend to move away from the issue when things get a little hot, when things get a little energetic, you know, when the conversation goes towards adult topics with adult language, if you want to censor that discussion, I'm not with you. I'm no longer with you on that. And I'm not saying you, Marianne, personally. I'm just saying in general. If that is my greatest criticism of liberals and people on the left, is that we're just way too accommodating sometimes, and we're way too willing to allow for those people, frankly, that belong in a separate discussion to control our discussion. And this is, Dan, this is where I tend to think that the way you energize that disenfranchised middle is to stop pretending like there's a middle ground. There isn't. There's no such thing. That's a logical fallacy. And the right has continued in the last 40 years to move the center further and further right, expecting us to follow them and expecting us to concede and to compromise. Well, I'm done compromising. And I have been done compromising for a while now. At this point, I'm staking a ground, and that is the left of center, where history proves this country has advanced, the middle class has thrived, when the center has been left of middle, not right of middle. What say you, Dan?
So, a couple of quick observations. First of all, Greg Russick, not a guy afraid to get angry. So you're the easy target. You're not the one that Marianne's talking about. Marianne's the one that Marianne's talking about. We know this, right? So here's the thing. And that's why I said, because I was the guy, and obviously you know this, in the chat room that typed, you got to get people pissed off. So I would ask, I don't know if Marianne, if you're still there, but let me give you this hypothetical. If a liberal, non-confrontational liberal, is walking past an alleyway in an urban setting, and he sees or she sees three people beating up a fourth, are they going to go, that's not right, I'm going to do something, whether they're going to call 911, whether they're going to jump in and help, whatever it is. Do you think a liberal is going to have a problem getting into that fight?
Are you Marianne is no longer.
I don't know. Oh, she's no longer here. Okay. My theory is no. Because why? Because they're going to get angry. That angers you. That hits you in a place, a gut level, where you're going, that's not right, and I'm not going to let that happen. That's why I say if you get people angry enough, they will move. Now, to your point, Greg, what you're really talking about is something you and I know because we do this for a living. It's marketing. Right? In marketing, you state your case, and then there's always a call to action. And the people on the right have been so good about it, and again, using that anger, right? Oh, government government sucks. It's evil. They can't do anything right. We need to drown it in a bathtub, blah, blah, blah. And people go, government sucks. And they go, but they don't stop to think it sucks because the people on the right are controlling it, and the rich and the wealthy are controlling it for their ends. So of course they're going to be mad at the government. So it works. They have perfected the marketing angle, and they know how to do it, and they know how to play it. And, as I said before, they control the methods by which those messages get to the public and the people that set the conversation, being the media. So they figured it out, and they got it locked down. And if we're not going to get mad about it, then we're not going to take action.
I totally agree, Dan, that one of the most fundamental emotions that need to be put into emotions that need to get energized is this notion of righteous. I love Jack's idea of, you know, militant moderate. Frankly, I would love it if there were more people that would kind of take that whole approach, and I would be willing to find and work with them to find compromise, so long as that compromise isn't me having to agree with that ultra-conservative position on things like economic policy, on things like social policy, on the things that you brought up earlier, even around things like government programs, like an attack on the problems in our infrastructure. I've blogged about this in the past, that would be one of the most patriotic things that conservatives and liberals ought to be getting together on, is for no other reason than the fact that infrastructure is not a private enterprise. It's a public good, and we all ought to be in it together to improve upon it, because without it, we don't actually have a functioning society and a functioning economy. And so this notion that the government, big bad government, ought to not be raising taxes on those who can afford to pay them to fund the kind of programs that are actually required to improve our highway systems, our rail systems, our ports, our airports. Those are things that private enterprise simply cannot do. And what still continues to mystify me is how it is that an idea like that doesn't energize and galvanize the 60% of voters who are sitting on the sidelines. And the only conclusion I can come to is because of what you like to talk about, Dan, bread and circus.
Well, let me suggest this, Greg. I would suggest to you that, let's say we entered that debate. I think how it would go is, I think actually they would agree. Those on the right would agree. But here's where the road meets the fork, right? Or here's where the road forks. And that is, the left would say that government needs to headman these projects, maybe even like the CCC hiring directly people to do these mm-hmm. things, you know, and they are going to run mm-hmm. it. And the people on the right are going to go, the government sucks. They don't know how to do anything right. So what we want you to do is, yeah, go ahead, raise taxes. That's fine. But then funnel all of that to let's just call it Halliburton or a Halliburton-like mm-hmm. company mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. privatize the actual work. And therefore, the money goes right back into their pockets and then some.
Yeah, so that's an interesting sort of decision point that maybe would have to get made. And honestly, Dan, I would not be completely opposed to the idea of some of the government's funds going to private enterprise in order to realize the improvements that we would need in infrastructure. If I had to make a choice, if it was a binary choice, I would choose the direct hire by the government, just the way my father was hired by the government and worked in Civilian Conservation Corps. My father was part of that program, as were many young men. It was mostly men early in the 20th century. And, you know, the interesting piece of that program was, and imagine how this would go over today. Out of the 20 bucks I think he made in a month, I think it was that, 15 of it was sent directly home. He didn't even
yep.
get it. The majority of that compensation was actually sent back to the worker's family so that the worker's family could spend that money back into the economy to help get the country out of its depression. It's pretty simple stuff. That
yep.
doesn't happen with private enterprise. The people who run corporations, and I'm not saying people who run corporations as if they are evil, because they're not. I am what I call a conscientious capitalist. I have made my living, as you pointed out, in sales and marketing for the last 25 years. I understand how the economy works on a couple of levels. I've had my own businesses. I've been responsible for profit and loss as a general manager. I know how this stuff works. The bottom line is this. An organization has a responsibility to its funders, whether they're shareholders or venture capitalists or someone else. That is the only measurement, unfortunately, in a pure – well, no, I was going to say purely capitalist because we're not purely capitalist. In a capitalist economy like ours, that's the overriding force. Now, my feeling is that it doesn't have to be that way. And we're starting to see, thankfully, some titans of industry, if you want to call them that, actually take advantage of the notion that, you know, there can be a different way. There can be a better way to make money without doing harm. Remember, that used to be Google's slogan, so much for that, I guess, lately. I'm not sure that's really that's not really as manifest as maybe it once was. But when it comes to getting the economy moving again, here's my feeling about this, and I think you would probably agree. Trickle-down economics has had its day. It had its chance. It has brought us to where we are now. I don't know how anyone could deny that statement of fact. We have not been in a country run by a government that is about largesse. It has been, in fact, the opposite of that. Regardless of what conservatives want to say about the people who are unfortunately having to take advantage of social safety net programs, you know, if there are no jobs, what do you expect someone to do? Just starve to death? To just die? If they can't get, if the only job they can get is $7.25 an hour at Walmart, I got news for you, brother. Do the math. That's $14,000 a year. What do you expect somebody to do in terms of contributing to the economy if that's the only job available where they live and they got no other way of getting somewhere?
You're absolutely right. And but here's the thing, right? So to discuss the economics that have made it a fertile ground for people to take advantage of other people, I mean that's a whole another 2 or 3 or 4 hour show we could do, right? But it's real simple, and that is this: real wages in this country went up from basically the time it was founded to about 1970, and that's what happened. Wages kept going up and up and up. There was lots of opportunity. But two things have happened. The population continues to grow, outpacing the job market, and then we had technology, right, like computers and robotics and whatnot, that have eliminated a lot of jobs. And therefore, we now have more people than we have jobs. And when you have that situation, when you have a glut, it's simple supply and demand, right? If I have a huge supply of people, the demand goes down, therefore I can pay them less because they'll take whatever scraps I throw them. That's what has allowed capitalism to run amok or to run awry or whatever the proper term is, is that we have this imbalance. And nobody wants to talk about that, and nobody wants to recognize that. And then, of course, it was worsened, by the way, by globalization, right? Now we can offshore things and go to super cheap labor markets where they have no regulations or environment or regulations or worker OSHA, right? So it's the perfect storm. So now the thing is, we have to change the paradigm. That's the problem.
Right.
We can't just be unfettered capitalists like we were when there was opportunity growth. There is no more growth, opportunity growth. So how do we now face this today in America and say, the old model doesn't work, we need a new one?
Right. I completely agree. The religion of growth that has been really at the cornerstone of the expansion of wealth and power of the United States, especially in the 21st century, was predicated on this idea that growth is an unlimited and highly desirable concept, especially when it comes to an economy. And that's possible, I believe, only when the average citizen buys into that idea and then supports policies and politicians that also want to create a legislative landscape in which private enterprise and growth is as unregulated and unbridled as it potentially can be, all with the expectation that everything good that comes to the top will end up somehow making its way down to us. Now, there's a comment in the chat room that I find interesting, and this is something I've thought about as well. They make the point that Australia, I guess, is, and this is the claim, I don't know it to be true, but it probably, I'm sure that it is, Australia will fine its citizens who don't vote.
Absolutely true. It's mandatory to vote in Australia. The law says you have to vote. If you don't, you will get fined.
So that's and again, we've only got 14 minutes left. We could talk on this one at least for another hour, I'm sure of it. But what the point that is also made in conjunction with that comment is that now we are actually allowing our elected officials to move us in a direction where voting is actually becoming more inaccessible and hence discouraging. And these are policies, Dan, you know what? There's just absolutely no way to deny this. These are policies that come from the Republican Party, and they come from the Republican Party because they are trying to rig the game even further in order to keep people who tend to vote Democrats from being able to cast their votes. There's just no way around that fact. None.
Not going to disagree.
So my question is, I know you will. That's fine. We've got 13
No,
minutes.
I said I'm not going to disagree. I said I'm not going to disagree.
Okay.
No.
I was a little surprised by that. So should we, as we start to wind down the show, is the way to get the middle, who's totally disenfranchised, uninterested, won't engage, do we make it the law of the land that they must?
It's an interesting concept because that is truly circular logic when you think about it, right? We're a country of laws, right? Where the democracy says we vote in people, they create the laws, and then we follow the laws. Mm-hmm. So what we're really doing is saying we're not doing the right job, so we're going to force ourselves to do the right job. It's a very interesting circular argument. The easy answer for me is, of course. Of course you do. And then the chat room, there's a good, you know, solution as well, which is you make it a national holiday. And
yes.
then I'll
yeah.
tell you the third
yes.
I'll tell you the third solution. For the last 4 years I voted by mail in Oregon. We vote by mail here. And guess what? In Oregon,
yeah.
you have 70-80% turnout ever since like the 1940s. You would never have less than 70% turnout. So that's another obvious step as far as I'm concerned. So there are lots of things we can do to reform the electoral process to make people to get people more involved.
All right, so I want to, I've left Jack on hold for a while now. I want to bring Jack back into this discussion as well. I want to ask you, Jack, what do you think about making voting mandatory? Would that, do you think, help persuade the people that are militant moderates like yourself, but who don't go and vote? Would that help?
I would say I was going to raise that very question. Why can't we be like Australia and make it mandatory to vote? And I think that maybe would get. I don't know about giving him fines, but trying to encourage. It's these people that vote in. They don't in Ferguson, for example, or in Kansas. They'll vote for these people that vote for extreme right wing candidates.
So, Jack, would it help you think?
Vote in primaries. Okay,
right.
Make the primaries. More than two
primary?
Candidates.
All right,
open
so Jack,
primaries.
Can you pick that?
They had it in California. I lived in California for 39 years.
Right.
I was back in 88 or so, they had over 100 people running for governor, I believe.
So, Jack, Jack, we don't have a lot of time left tonight, and you brought up an important point that I want to take back over to Dan, and that is the notion of
open primaries.
Now, Dan, before you respond, Dan, here's my take on primaries in and of themselves. Right now, I live in Pennsylvania. They have closed primaries. I am not a member of the club, so to speak. So I have come to accept the idea that if I'm not a member of the club, the party, if I'm not a Democrat or a Republican, and Jack, I am going to apologize to put you back on hold just because of a little bit of background noise. If I'm not a member of the club, then why should I, as an independent, as a registered independent, be able to vote for the candidate who will represent the club. I've actually never had a real problem with that idea. Now, what also happens in Pennsylvania is that you can't vote in primaries if you're registered as a Green or a Justice Party either. These things are limited to the two parties who are running primaries in our state. The other thing that Jack touched on and that you touched on, and I also agree with, is that it boggles my mind as to why Election Day is not a national holiday. I just think that that's kind of crazy, that something as important as casting your vote isn't something you get to do without having to take time off of work or figure out how you're going to do it going from one job to home or the next. Dan, what do you think about primaries? Quickly.
What do I think of? Oh, wow. That's a lot of different stuff. So primaries. I think I answer primaries like I answer my libertarian friends who say that government should leave them alone and not tell them what to do. I say, fine. Get off my power grid. Get off my streets. Get off my sewers. Get off. When I shoot you, don't call 911. They ain't coming. If you want to, if you're willing to give up all that stuff that is in the public good and the public interest and that we do together as a society, fine. Don't pay taxes. I'm fine with that. Go away. Same with primaries. This is my problem with primaries, Greg. They are for parties and only for parties, yet they are publicly funded. Take away the public funding. Make it, hey, look, Mr. Democrats, you want to have a primary? That's fine. That's your business. You get zero public assistance. You get zero access to public places. You don't get polling places. You don't get any of that stuff. This is your club, like you said. Run your club. Fine. Have your club. I don't care. But the fact that they get public resources to do it, that's why it has to be. It has to be. The only logical and just, the only way that it's just is to then make them open. Because you're using my school to run your primary out of, and you're using my funds to run your primary. No, then I get to participate. And everybody pays, and therefore everybody should be able to participate. That's called fairness.
That's an interesting take, Dan. I completely agree with this idea that if on some level you feel as if you want to live in and benefit from this society, but you don't want to contribute some fair share to it, then, you know, by all means, you know, there's plenty of, you know, uncharted wilderness somewhere else, you know, have at it. You know, whether you like
the cold or the
warmer.
The government forces me to pay for that. The government forces me to pay for those primaries, and the government forces the use of public places to do it, and therefore, and I own those public places. I'm part ownership in that. Therefore, you have to allow me to participate. You cannot bar me from participating. That's my take on primaries. One or the other.
Okay. All right. So now, all right. I'm sorry. Now I think I understand the point you're making better. Is that if it's going to be publicly funded, then you are in the wrong, essentially, to tell me that I can't participate because you're using some of my money to fund this exercise of democracy in which a political party is choosing who its representatives will be, and yet excluding me from being able to participate. Am I getting that?
Of course. Yeah, it would be like you going down to the train station, buying a ticket, and then somebody saying, "Now you can't get on the train, but hey, thanks for helping pay to keep the train running." In what world does that make sense? But that's what they're doing.
Yeah. Okay, so now I get what you're saying, and maybe now I'm going to have to start to rethink my position on this whole notion of should I or should I not be upset that I don't get a chance to exercise my voice in a primary if you're using my money to pay for it. That's what you're saying, right?
Sure. Well, go back to what the point of a primary is. The point of a primary is that they feel that if you try to run a general election with 100 candidates or 10 candidates, whatever it would be, that gets a lot more difficult. So the idea is it pares it down so that come general election time, you don't have to go back and do voting and revoting and revoting and revoting until you get a clear majority winner, right? So that's the whole point. But why should the Democrats get to pick from their four people and limit me to decide which of their four people ends up on the ballot? And why shouldn't I get to decide of the Democrats who I like and of the Republicans who I like and of the Greens who I like? And why shouldn't I get to have a say in all of those people who end up on my general ballot?
which brings us kind of right back to the idea of how is it that we can get more people engaged in the conversation? How is it that we can get more diversity in the representation that we have? That on some level, the duopoly is a little too similar for most people, or at least for some people, that they just won't even bother to engage. All those things kind of conspiring to keep us apart, to keep us kind of stuck in the mud, you know, with the status quo. And all while this is happening, while we spend an hour on a Saturday talking about and debating what it is that we can do to try and get our fellow citizens a little bit more activated and involved, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to do it again. I'm going to vilify the rich and the powerful for continuing to just squeeze whatever they can out of our system, all for their own personal benefit. And on some level, that's a psychosis that I think we ought to have another show about, because if you were living in the hoarder kind of analogy, I think actually has some value here. If somebody discovered that you were living in your house wall to wall with old newspapers from the 30s on up, and they would find you to be a little bit odd at best. They would worry that you weren't quite stable, that maybe you needed some help and maybe actually some intervention. You know, on some level, doesn't that apply to somebody who's so incredibly wealthy at this point? The Koch brothers combined have $90 billion in net worth, and yet they can't seem to let it go. At some level, you got to start asking questions about their mental health. I mean, isn't that something else that we maybe ought to think about as well? But we're starting to come down towards the end of our hour, and I'm gonna do my best to get through this part of it. I want to make sure and give everybody some understanding about what the coffee party is and what we're doing, especially when it comes to some of these radio shows. Again, I've had the honor and privilege today to sit in for Egberto Willis on his show, Politics Done Right. Comes to you every Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. On Sunday mornings, bright and early, Bobby Rodrigo does I Take Liberty with My Coffee. That program starts at 8:30 a.m. on Sundays. Trust me when I tell you, folks, skip the television Sunday morning talk shows. That stuff is BS. It's not going to tell you anything. Listen to Bobby Rodrigo. Listen to the guests that he brings in. You're going to get information and an education that you just won't be able to get anywhere else. Mondays, we've started a new program in which we're doing essentially an opportunity to do some book reviews to guest authors. We bring them in. I believe that's hosted mostly by Tim Denehay, and that's Mondays at 8 o'clock. If I get any of this wrong, by the way, go to blogtalkradio.com/coffeepartyusa. It's all one word. And then Thursdays, we have Lunch with Loudon. Lunch with Loudon airs at 12 noon Pacific time, a wonderful opportunity, and there's a series of guest hosts that are filling in for Janine right now. I encourage everyone to also go to coffeepartyusa.com. Think about helping the organization, contribute to its efforts. We're here to try and make positive changes in America. And frankly, obviously, it takes a little bit of cash to do that. So we're asking for your support. As Janine likes to say, Citizens United did not benefit us. Guys, I usually go around and give everybody a chance to give a last word, but unfortunately, we're down to less than 30 seconds at this point. I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to make sure and encourage everybody to be active, get engaged, have the conversation with friends and family. Don't be afraid to share your thoughts on the important issues of the day. And again, thanks for calling, Jack, Dan, Marianne, and everybody in the chat room. Appreciate your time. Have a great afternoon.